So our reading this morning is one that we've heard before on several Christmas Eves over the years. It's one of my favorites. It's from Pablo Neruda, and it is called Keeping Quiet. Penn and Peggy will read for us.
Now we will count to 12, and we will all keep still. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. For once on the face of the earth, let's not speak in any language. Let's stop for 1 second and not move our arms so much.
It would be an exotic moment, without rush, without engines. We would all be together in a sudden strangeness. Fishermen in the cold sea would not harm whales, and the man gathering salt would look at his hurt hands.
Those who prepare green wars, wars with gas, wars with fire, victories with no survivors, would put on clean clothes and walk about with their brothers. In the shade, doing nothing.
What I want should not be confused with total inactivity. Life is what it is about. I want no truck with death. If we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving, and for once could do nothing, perhaps a huge silence might interrupt this sadness of never understanding ourselves and of threatening ourselves with death. Perhaps the earth can teach us, as when everything seems dead and later proves to be alive.
Now I'll count up to 12, and you keep quiet, and I will go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
In the order of service, there is a good, perhaps intriguing to some of you, sermon title called Spelunking for the Spirit that I'm going to save for another time. Because this sometimes happens, the world interrupts our work with its work. That ever happened to you? And sometimes when that happens, the most important thing to do is to notice that the work are the interruptions, because they remind us to pay attention and remember in this time of me, myself, and I, that our agenda, the one that I have and that you have, is not always the most important thing. So instead, on Friday and then yesterday, my sermon writing days, I felt moved. This is after the order service is printed and stuffed. To begin with Nelson Mandela, how could I not? Who, as Bill Schultz, who's the director of the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, said in an email to all the ministers this week, he said, Nelson faced the greatest moral test of his life when he won his long battle against apartheid. Not before, but when he finally won. And if you're anything like me, I'm reading this and I'm thinking, really, Bill? That was when he faced his greatest moral test after he won? And the test was this. Nelson, what will you do when that moment of victory arrives in your life? Will you, Nelson, seek vengeance against those who imprisoned you for 26 years 18 of which were spent in a damp cell that measured 8 feet by 7 feet. There was a straw mat on the floor on which to sleep, which ultimately led you to develop tuberculosis later in life. It's 8 foot by 7 foot. And I've taped out here on the floor as you walk out so you can see just how small that space is. What will you do, Nelson? Nelson, will you seek vengeance against those who force you to spend every day from 8 in the morning till 5 p.m. working in a lime quarry? And those people, they forbid you to wear sunglasses. So as you grew older, your eyesight was permanently damaged. And while at night you worked in that cell on your law degree with no access to newspapers or books, and who put you in solitary confinement whenever they discovered smuggled newspaper clippings under the floor mat that you slept on. Nelson, will you seek vengeance against those who allowed you to receive one letter every 6 months and one visit every 6 months on alternating schedules? Not even allowing you, Nelson, to attend the funeral of your mother who died in 1968, or the funeral of your firstborn son, Tembi, who died in 1969 in a car accident, leaving you to offer your own memorial, Nelson, in that cell, all alone in the darkness. Nelson, what will you do? And Nelson, when you were freed in 1990, living your life in prison, I'm realizing, longer than at that point than I had been alive. I've been alive. I'm 42, then I'd been alive. Nelson, will you punish all those who did this to you? Utilizing some of your training early in life for guerrilla warfare and military action against the government. Did you know this about him, by the way? That he was trained to fight? I mean, Nelson, no one would blame you if you did any of that. None of us would be surprised, would we? And so, Nelson, by the time you are free and apartheid is over, and you find yourself president of South Africa in 1994, Nelson, what will you do? The time is now to choose. Because never mind passing some anonymous moral test, the temptations to do unto others what had been done to you must be so strong. And now, Nelson, you have the power. And now, Nelson, you have the means. And no one will think any less of you if you go after them with a vengeance. Nelson. And yet, this is what you do, Nelson. You form the Rainbow Coalition, and you ensure South Africa's white population is protected and represented in the new government. You name F.W. de Klerk, the country's last apartheid-era president, as deputy president, Nelson. Really, what are you doing? You meet personally with senior figures of the apartheid regime. And at that meeting, you emphasize personal forgiveness and reconciliation. And you say to them, and you get up on a podium in a stadium, and you say, courageous people, do not fear forgiving for the sake of peace. And maybe most of all, Nelson, you encourage black South Africans to get behind the previously hated national rugby team, the Springboks, in time, of course, for the 95 World Cup. And after the Springboks win an epic battle against New Zealand in the final, you, Nelson, present a trophy to the captain, I'm sure I'll get this pronunciation wrong, Francois Pienaar, who's a white Afrikaner, while wearing the Springbok shirt with his number on the back, number 6. A move that was widely seen, for those of you that think sports do not matter, widely seen as a major step in the reconciliation of white and black South Africans. There is a great movie about this, by the way, called Invictus. I encourage you to see it, with Matt Damon and, of course, Morgan Freeman as Mandela. It's a great movie for kids. And finally, and most controversially, you, Nelson, oversee the Truth and Reconciliation Commission to investigate the crimes committed during apartheid by both the white government and, Nelson, your own ANC government, appointing none other than Desmond Tutu to chair the committee. All of this you can read on Wikipedia. So if you're like me, you're thinking, wow, right? Saint, right? Tutu says he was Christ-like, right? I mean, while people like Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher described you, Nelson, in the 80s as a, quote, communist terrorist, and Dick Cheney and others, including Reagan, famously voted against sanctions against South Africa in 1986, only, by the way, to be outvoted by moderate Republicans, including none other than Mitch McConnell. Believe it, that's right. Believe it. That was my answer, too, when I first read that. Who grew up in the South, by the way, Mitch did, and said, I know racism when I see it. So this vote will not stand. You are a man, after all of these things said about you, Nelson, who on Friday after your death earned superlatives from Obama and David Cameron and Pope Francis, expected, expect that, and President Putin and China, who both hailed you as a liberator from imperialism. I'm not expecting that one as much, actually. And then even unbelievably, maybe you read this with me, from President Bashar Assad, president of Syria, who's accused of crimes against his own people in the civil war, but who said on Friday, quote, Nelson, you are an inspiration to the values of love and human brotherhood. Wow, right? So sometimes I notice what happens to me, it happens inside of me, when I hear stories like this and superlatives about human heroism and moral courage like this. What happens in me, there's the inspiration, of course, that happens, but something else happens too. Sometimes I feel like I can never measure up. That ever happen to you? Sometimes I catch myself, like on Friday when I should have been writing my sermon, that people like Mandela are the spiritual equivalent of Tom Brady in his prime. Notice in his, it's a reference to the past. A gifted, superlative athlete, Nelson, whose talents that I can never match. That ever happened to you? And then, of course, the next thought, so why even try? Why even try, Nathan, to forgive that family member who's given you a lifetime of woe and angst? Why, Nathan, reconcile in time for the holidays with that estranged friend whose values that I share, not one, even a little tiny one, iota? Why even forego the suburban guerrilla warfare of hand signals to that driver who just buzzed me yesterday while I was out on the bike, who I'm sure was texting his girlfriend with the acronym YOLO, YOLO, you only live once, while threatening my once and only once lived life. This is for you, buddy. This is for you. I'm only imagining this, of course. You know that. Why measure up? Am I alone here? Desmond Tutu said this week that his greatest fear in losing his friend, Nelson, is that he would become to you and me some distant and saccharine, notice that word, saccharine moral icon that we place up in a pulpit or up on a pedestal and we idolize him. Far enough away from our lives, just far enough, that nothing is expected much from us other than laudatory praise. Just think about that for a second. He worries that we will praise him so much, just put him far enough away, that the only thing we have to do is get down on bended knee and say, what a great guy, what a great man. I couldn't measure up. I can never be like that. You know, all this reminds me of the line about Jesus that I have offered us before, Jesus who was a Jew. How the early Unitarians, who were still expressly Christian, sought in their congregations to be a religion that followed Jesus and not a religion that worshiped Jesus. How they sought to create a religion not about anybody, but instead inspired from their example. As my grammar teacher told us in the seventh grade, it is all about the preposition. So here you and I are. I've set aside the sermon that I thought I would give today, and there's music next week, the Messiah, and there's so much to do. It is mid-December, it is 2013, and I'm wondering with you, where have the years gone? Where have the years gone? And while we're listening to the plaudits and the praise of Mandela from the pew this morning and from the newspaper, very soon, if not already, in the 24-hour news cycle, another story will take our eye. And another differently themed Sunday will happen here. And the holidays are arriving with all of their intricate blessing and woe. And there are presents to buy, and there are visits to plan, and the in-laws are coming in for me in a week and a half. And there are houses to adorn with glad tidings. And there's joy to the world to sing, supposedly, even for some of you who find a lump in your throat because you've lost someone this year, or worry about your life is taking over your spirit. And joy is so hard to find. And you hear all of that with me, and you hear about Mandela, and this is how the conversation sounds. Yeah, he was an amazing guy. He's really amazing. Hey, what's on your mom's Christmas list? Hey, and when's your uncle coming into town? I hope he doesn't bring his new girlfriend, because I got stuck talking to her in the corner on Thanksgiving, and I thought my head was going to explode. I can never forgive your uncle for leaving your aunt like that. And we're off into our lives, never taking the time. So in response to all this, it might seem strange, especially in thinking of Mandela, to hear a poem that Penn and Peggy read for us, asking us to keep quiet and to keep still. Because when it comes to oppression, of course, the one thing that we cannot do is keep quiet and keep still. But whereas silence was not Mandela's work, I wonder actually if here and now, in this room, it is our work. We who are measured, you and I, so much by how busy we are, we wear it like badges on our arms. We are measured so much by how much we say we do, and less by who we say we are. What will it mean for us to stop the hustle and the bustle enough to ask ourselves what we have to learn and how we want to be and what we are called to do in response to the example that Nelson has left us? On Thursday night, before I came here for the board meeting in my home, these questions were hanging over the dinner table as the news was turned down to a hush and the warm food was served. And our two children, Emerson, who played drums today, and Ella, who is 10, asked their questions of innocence that only, please hear me, the privileged get to ask. Only the privileged. Dad, what is apartheid? Dad, how come the white people did not let the black people vote? Dad, what is racism? Did they say, Dad, that he lived in an 8-foot-long and 7-foot-wide cell with no bed? Dad, how? Dad, what does reconciliation mean? Dad, he tried to forgive them? I can't even forgive my sister. Dad, is it different now? Is it different now? Is it different now? And as these questions hung over the table, outside the window, the LED lights on the trees, they twinkled in the night, and the moon, like this crescent moon, hung in the night sky. And the promise of the holidays would say, O come, Emmanuel. Emmanuel is the name that means God is with us, the Spirit is with us, we hope, was in the air. Answers to all of these questions at my dining room table would come. They actually take a lifetime to come. But I'm thinking with you on Thursday night and now. First, some silence, some stillness, some pondering, because such profound questions that only the privileged get to ask provoke such profound time. And they deserve a time for keeping quiet. My friends, let us rise in body or spirit and sing, Find a Stillness. Thank you. In our religious community, it is not how hard we believe, but rather how hard and with what love and grace we live, which is why we say together our call to ministry every Sunday. Say with me, we go forth into the world in peace to act with works of love, to affirm each person's dignity, and to cherish our living earth. Our benediction is from Desmond Tutu, and these words are the response that he gave to the question, Desmond, what is the ideal that Nelson will represent through history, through the ages, to people everywhere? And here is his response. The essence is goodness, and this is the wonder. Where you thought people are cynical, people who are skeptics, people even who are secularists, who poo-poo spiritual values, but when they encounter a good person, it's amazing, they become reverent. Because we are actually made, you and I, for that goodness. And there's an excitement that people have to see it embodied in a person. But it is actually achievable in the world when there is so much disillusionment and where people see so many who are eager to use their positions and to feather their nests. To have someone like Nelson who is genuinely altruistic makes you feel good. It makes you feel as good when you see that young man, remember, in Beijing, standing in front of a tank. We said and we say it is good to be human, to see that there is this kind of courage in the world.